Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. Welcome to this very special episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, and we are releasing this episode because it's World Mental Health Day coming up on the 10th of October, and the topic for this year is mental health in an unequal world. There's no denying that for people with a serious mental health condition, inequality is a reality. And today I've got Bella with me, and Bella is going to be joining us to talk about what she's doing to revolutionize this and turn this around, and through slow change, because it will take time, bring a new understanding of what mental health illness is and how we can actually access that help, and how that further goes down into different communities within the mental health community itself. So bipolar is a serious mental health condition, and it does pose inequality just at that level, but I really want to talk to Bella about how this affects her community, the Black community, and why they may feel, and why it is actually harder for them to access care because of the generational learnings and understandings that are taught in our house from our grandparents to our parents and down. So Bella, welcome to Let's Talk Bipolar. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well. Thank you, Emma. And thank you so much for inviting me on this special episode. I'm thrilled to be part of it.
I'm really excited to have you here. And we've just had a quick chat before we started recording, so I'm really excited about the conversation we're going to have today. Bella is a mental health speaker, and she motivates delegates to understand that they can still achieve their dreams and become successful despite struggling with mental health. Bella lives with bipolar disorder and is a suicide attempt survivor. She also has childhood abuse, and she's a survivor of that and has PTSD and a personality disorder. So Bella lives this every single day, and she is now helping communities to find their voice, to find their strength, and to advocate for themselves and to get the help that they need. So Bella, will you tell us a bit about what you do and how you're helping other people in this arena, and let's unpack this together.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And you hit the key word, using your voice. And this is the start goal and end goal to my job role as a professional speaker and podcaster. In my community, the Black community, we are in a mental health crisis, mm-hmm. and we are almost stuck in a generational cultural loophole. And it brings to the topic of inequality, especially where we are approaching World Mental Health Day. Where we are currently in our community is Black people have a fear of seeking help from their doctor when they are currently struggling with mental health. And there are many different reasons for this. The unfortunate deliberating result of this means that when a Black person is struggling with mental health and they fear they don't want to go to the doctor, their mental health will deteriorate. Now, in our community, we have different factors to why this has happened. And we have been told, and we have a generational expectation to be the strong Black woman, to be the strong Black man, and also indirectly told not to feel. So the consequences are that if Black people are going through a mental health problem or issue or struggle, they're going to feel ashamed, because mm-hmm. they're going to think, I've been grown up or taught not to feel. What's this happening? And also, because there haven't been mental health conversations using our voice, many people in the Black community are not aware of the symptoms. If it's a common mental health issue such as anxiety or depression or trauma, these are new feelings. They really don't know what they are because we're not having conversations. So when many people in my community are going through mental health problems, there's a scared feeling, there's an embarrassment feeling. So they let alone can't even speak to themselves or acknowledge, let alone telling another person. So the fear of going to the doctor is a hazardous feeling because there's a feeling of acknowledging yourself to make that motivation. Then there's also the feeling of inequality, because statistics show, if I'm correct, and there is a blog I did for Bipolar UK, 8% is represented of Black doctors within the NHS. So when they go to the doctors, they're not seeing somebody like themselves who can understand the cultural background. And there is that elephant in the room that there have been inequalities within the NHS. And then it goes back to the cultural perception of the angry Black man, the angry Black woman. And sometimes when a Black person presents themselves at the doctors, they're so distressed, they may not know how to communicate directly. So it's seen as the angry Black woman, the angry Black men. And then sometimes the repercussions mean they may not be diagnosed correctly, or they feel like the doctor wasn't compassionate, wasn't communicating in the way they needed. So they're not going to go back. Mm-hmm. So that is some of the challenges we're facing in our Black community and with the labels and the inequality.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a bit more about growing up as a Black woman and a Black child in your family with elders around you? If somebody was presenting with what we now know, what you now know, what I now know as symptoms of mental health illness, how would that have been spoken about around you? And what would have been the attitude towards that? Like, what would you have been absorbing as that young person in that environment? Or was it just not spoken about at all?
That's a really, really good question. And the answer to that is the generational influence. So as a Black person, we do define ourselves as African Black, Caribbean Black. Whether you're from an African background or a Caribbean background, we kind of share the same attitudes towards mental health. And the attitudes within the family home is our cultures are very much what stays in the house must keep in the house. You know, I referred it to the Las Vegas saying, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. You know, and I've been to Las Vegas, so I know what goes on. You know,
it's quite fun. You know. So I think it's more fun than living with bipolar, to be fair. I'd rather have Vegas.
Because it's 24 hours, you know. So in the family household, many of us, I'm not saying all of us, but many of us as grown up, we have this approach in our Black community of how we look, how we seen, our vision. We have to look good all the time. Even if you don't have food in your fridge, you know, keep up appearance, you know. This saying that's very familiar. If you get knocked down by a bus, make sure you have clean underwear on. Do you know what I mean? And then we have a culture of don't wash your dirty linen in public, you know. So the approach very much, which has also come from living in any country in Africa or any West Indian countries, that if somebody in the family home or in the neighborhood has got mental health, you keep it hush hush. You don't want to tell anyone because there's that stigma. You know, it's almost like the stigma of somebody being gay, you know, or the only gay one in the village, you know of him, but nobody wants to talk about it. So we've had this stigma. And I think it's because a fear that we have seen mental health as a really bad thing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a bad health, but it's not seen as mental health is health. And also the very negative labeling, the person's gone to the madhouse, mm-hmm. the mental hospital, or they're crazy. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, whether we are now Black British, born in London or the UK, those generational sayings have kept with us.
Yeah.
Because when our parents or grandparents originally lived in the West Indies, Caribbean or Africa, that's what happened when they were living in those times. And we really have to understand, from an equality point of view and migration, mm-hmm. our elders, if we really look at the timeline, have not lived in the UK that long.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we haven't, because it's really only if we look at it, our mothers and fathers may have been born here, mm-hmm. but it was our grandparents that came, say, on the boat, what we say, in the 50s.
Yeah.
And our grandparents are something between the ages of 80 to 90. I've got my grandmother's photograph when she came to London, and she was 20, and she's about 83. She won't mind me saying her age, so we can do the maths, right? So it's not really that long ago.
Yeah.
So we're also having to adapt to the new London modern way of living, where my generation, I don't mind saying my age, you know, I'm 43, I don't feel a day past 21, but you know, I'm born and bred in London, so our approach is sort of different. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the difficulties that we have been battling is that we are living in a modern world, mental health is becoming more aware, and we want to break the cycle, but we still know the culture. Mm-hmm. And culture in any setting, whether it's work culture, whether it's music culture, industry, film, a culture is a very big mole that does not get broken easily. It takes a while. It's like mole grown on, I don't know, a rotten fruit or greater than that. It takes a while for it to, it's like ice. It takes a while for it to melt down.
It does, yeah. And can I ask you, so you're living with bipolar, and I'm curious to know what you thought when you were being diagnosed or coming to the realization that you were living with a mental health illness. Did you carry any of these ideas or stigmas or attitudes towards yourself in that process? How did this come out for you?
Yeah. Absolutely. I remember the day like it was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I remember having to go to the hospital because I was in a manic state. Mm-hmm. Although when I go through bipolar, I do have memory loss, but there's a lot of things I remember. I remember it like yesterday. Mm-hmm. I remember my family supporting me. I remember the psychiatrist informing us, we're going to make a diagnosis, we've got to do a few more tests, but we're going to make the diagnosis. Then I can remember telling me the diagnosis. I can remember asking multiple questions. I was diagnosed 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I remember asking multiple questions. I've been ill with mental health since I was 16.
That was my next question I was going to ask.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
when we get diagnosed and when it affects us, have two very different answers, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I know we are going to cover that, why it takes so long. So I was asking those questions. I've had panic attacks, depression, how comes? And then I remember, you know, I don't know if it's like still like a dream, because I still remember it in my dream. Like, it's almost like they take you into a little room or try to comfort you, to tell you you've got a long-term chronic illness. It's never going to grow away, called bipolar. And I was already on medication for depression and you will be on medication forever.
Mm.
Is this going to go? No. They've already told you it's long term, but you're repeating the questions just to be sure. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
So I'm having this forever. Yes. And they're nodding. Then you try to ask a different question. Is this long term? Yes. Forever. Will medication help me? Yes. Do I have to take medication for life? Yes. Oh. Then you're almost frozen for a little while. So I can probably recall, it probably took me a few months for it to really digest. Mm-hmm. And what I do know is, because it's 13 years of my celebration, it's taken me 13 years to get rid of that shame to share. So I went through that stigma that the same people in my community are. I never told no one. Mm-hmm. I hid it. When I was sick, I hid in my home for days.
How long did you live with the diagnosis? We're going to talk a bit about the bit beforehand in a minute. But from when you got diagnosed to when you started to feel safe enough to start sharing what was really going on with you?
Years. Years, because I would say maybe 5-6 years, I started to tell people. Because I really had to, like my mentor, I really had to, because my work was deteriorating. Mm-hmm. Before that, up until 6 years, I told no one. And the reason I told no one is the diagnosis was so severe. As you live with bipolar, you know how severe that is. Mm-hmm. It is very difficult to explain to a person what that mm-hmm. is. And another person is probably going to feel scared. And you will feel, they will judge you, because it's a very unusual illness, because your mood goes up and down. Mm-hmm. You know, a person would think, take it personal. Your mood is towards them, or you're being, and it's absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I had to come to terms with how to manage the bipolar. It took me really 5-6 years. And also I still had a lot of episodes, and I was still getting unwell, and I was still adjusting to the medication as well. That's what another people don't realize. Sometimes when you're diagnosed with a mental illness, just adjusting to the medication, it went up, went down. I had put on weight. People thought I was pregnant. I tried to get all these belts from New Look to style it out, you know. Oh. Just the management. Forget the illness of bipolar, the management of bipolar.
It's a full-time job.
It is a full-time job in a nanny. Job. You know. just the first 6 years.
You're so right.
It was just, and it was exhausting. Just the management. And then you have to concentrate on the illness and also your family around you, because I've done a mental health awareness course in level 2, and I understand how an illness can affect your family. Yeah. So my family as well. So it took me maybe 6 years. And then when it was 6 years, I was so specific who I told, because it had to be somebody I trusted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting to 13 years to share, you know, I really became brave by that time. And I was like, forget it. For my own sharing my truth, everybody just has to know now. And that's it. Who wants to judge me? If it's one less friend, well, that's one less ping on my WhatsApp, you know.
Yes. And this is the thing, like, and what I hear and what you're saying is, and I resonate with a lot of what you're saying in terms of the sharing aspect and how we get to a place where we feel safe enough to do that, is by practicing sharing in safe spaces. Absolutely. Over time. And every time we practice sharing our truth in a safe space, we get more courage. And we shed shame, and we are able to move through those feelings with a bit more reassurance that the whole world's not going to implode after I've said this.
Absolutely.
And guess what? These people aren't going to run away, and you open your eyes and they're still there and you think, oh wow, they didn't go, okay, well maybe I can do that again, and maybe I can do it again.
Absolutely. It was like a domino effect, one person, and you almost, I don't know if you felt this, Emma, you're waiting in anticipation on how that person's going to react, because that's almost your borderline and your green traffic light on how you're going to approach another person.
Absolutely, which is why it's so useful to risk assess where you're going to first share, I think, because for example, one of my first sort of sharing spaces was with Bipolar UK at one of their peer groups, and I hadn't met anybody else that had bipolar, and I wasn't necessarily shameful that I had bipolar, but I couldn't, because I didn't know anyone else that had bipolar. I was terrified, you know, A, of what anyone else with bipolar would be like. Are they going to be really crazy, more crazy than me? And then what am I going to do about that? You know, I had that fear of, am I sort of putting myself in a place with crazy people, right? Because I just hadn't met anyone else with bipolar. So I had the fear of the rest of the bipolar community. What did that look like? What does that mean? Who am I aligning myself with? Is that going to make other people think I'm crazy? Because some of those people are really crazy, even though I was really crazy. You know, I use this crazy in air quotes, you know, I feel like we can, but I feel like we can say that about ourselves if we want, but
yes,
see what I mean? Even I had some of these stigmatized ideas and language, and I went into that room and I was terrified. I was terrified of if I would be the craziest person in the room, and they would all, even the bipolar community might look at me and think, well, you're really mad. And I sat in that room and I shared, and I sort of heard everyone else sharing their, you know, some of what the sort of more out there things that had come about of them having bipolar, and I started to think, oh, maybe these are my people. and I shared mine, something that I'd done that was completely off the wall in a manic, hypermanic episode. And I sort of had my head down in shame, and I looked up and everyone else in the room was kind of looking, going, yeah, happens. And I was like, oh my gosh. And it was just, the shedding of shame in that moment was enormous for me. And gave me that courage to go, okay, well, I've done it once there and that was okay, and now I might try again, you know, in a more measured way, with people that don't have bipolar, for example,
right.
And you get more and more confident as it goes
definitely,
but it's definitely practice, right?
Absolutely. And I have to applaud you, because you were able to maximize and invest in resources that I wasn't aware of. So from the first year I was diagnosed all the way up until 13 years, I wasn't even really aware of charities or websites or peer support. So I never spoke to another single person who had bipolar. So you're so fortunate to have been able to be in that peer environment to hear what other people had bipolar.
It took a year. It took a year after getting diagnosed. Well, and the reason it did is I ended up in another group, which was a Depression Alliance group. And I was listening to everyone share, and I could relate to what they were saying about depression, but I was waiting for someone to share the hypermanic or the manic bit, and nobody did. And I kept thinking, oh my God, I'm an alien here. Like, nobody is going to understand, because they were talking about the fact that they always feel depressed. And I was thinking, that's part of my story, but it's not all of my story. And and eventually, you know, I found this bipolar support group, thankfully. And that was a real turning point. And I was fearful of going in, if I'm honest.
Yeah. How was your experience in terms of getting the right diagnosis on time? Was yours delayed? Did you get your diagnosis earlier? Because mine took a long time for them to figure out it was bipolar.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, one of the questions I ask everyone, and we're going to talk about this with you in a moment, is when did you get your diagnosis? But when was your life first affected by? And the answers are very often, not always actually, but quite often different. So for me, my life was first affected unknowingly to me by bipolar when I was about 15, I think. And I then got diagnosed with depression because, of course, I didn't present myself to a doctor until I was low, because when I was high, I was just a crazy teenager, right?
Yes. So they might have seen it as just hormone. Oh, she's just a teenager.
And I was off the rails, and you know, there was various
rebellion that, teenager. That's how they're gonna look at it.
Yeah, there was various things going on, you know, with my sexual assault with an uncle, and you know, all sorts of things that would have contributed to an off the rails Emma just being put down to that rather than a hypomanic episode, or which it really was sometimes. So I got diagnosed with depression, got put on antidepressant, ended up star-shaped in front of a bus because it sent me sky high, and then stopped taking it because I was terrified. But of course, it wasn't the right drug for someone with bipolar. So of course I went sky high. So then I didn't take any medication at all. I was terrified of it for like 10 years, threw myself into like self-development stuff, you know, mind over matter. If you just keep pushing through, you can achieve anything, you know, that thinking that, you know, you can just think your way out of stuff.
Yes.
And I threw myself into that, which was part of another hypomanic episode where I got completely obsessed with all that stuff.
Yeah, because we do that with bipolar. One little thing, we get so obsessed. 2,000%. It's like our single focus. So yeah, I'm like that.
And then I'm
like that with songs. One song a month, I listen to it over and over.
Until you can never listen to it again.
Yeah.
So funny. And then I then had another period of being very unwell and got diagnosed with depression again, and then went sky high and had a complete manic episode. And that's when I got diagnosed. But 15, I got diagnosed when I was 29, 30.
Wow.
So I know we've touched on it slightly, but I'd love to hear your experience of that, because this comes into like the whole inequality piece.
Absolutely, it does. Yeah. And gosh, my story was, I literally have had a psychological problem since age 5. I have struggled with mental illness since age 5. Between the ages of 5 to 13, I was sexually abused by 3 boys. And I told nobody until I was in my 40s. And what I understand now from my psychiatrist is sexual abuse will affect mental health and mental illness as you get older. So at the end of it, age 13 to 16, I had immense trauma that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I did try to commit suicide, and I had very bad social anxiety, social skills. I didn't have a lot of friends. Age 16, in my teenage, I was severely depressed and I would have panic attacks. So I got a medication and treatment for depression, panic attacks. But I was always, and a lot of people would always know me as Bella always has energy, loads of energy. Do you know what I mean? And we know that's bipolar, don't we now? Energy, you know, very energy. And then the depression was severe. I had really bad depression, very bad depression all through my 20s, and feeling suicidal. And similar to yourself, around the age 29, 30, I had a manic episode, really bad manic episode. And that was what led me into hospital. And then they were able to make the diagnosis. And in between those years, teenage years to 30, I was seeing psychiatrists. I was within the mental health services. My trauma was never really picked up. My personality disorder was never picked up. And they were never able to pick up the bipolar. It took them a long time to diagnose it.
And the trauma piece is massive. Because I don't know what you feel, but for me, like similarly, I had unresolved trauma from sexual trauma. And working out what was part of my condition and what was part of my conditioning,
yes,
has been so important, because
absolutely
one triggers
Emma.
The other. And
it
if we
does, Emma. You know, like
if we don't get to work with it, it's not like we can just say, oh, they've all right. And I say they've all got bipolar, so give them this.
Absolutely.
No, we all come from different homes, right?
Absolutely.
So your upbringing, coming from a Black family with all of these generational kind of ideas, stigmas, mm-hmm, and attitudes mm-hmm. towards mental health, will have had a different impact on you than me growing up in a white home that had other things going on.
Absolutely, and absolutely.
You can't treat everyone the same. And that's why I'm loving having this conversation with you today.
Absolutely.
Because everyone's experiences are different, and we have to, yes, we might have bipolar, and we all have our childhood stuff, and we have to understand what triggers us, how we respond to stress, how we respond to distress, because these are the things that trigger our mental health condition to suddenly go into a period of being very unwell. So I think learning how to be mindful of these things, and then how do we learn, like you say, with what you're doing, how do we learn to communicate our needs? How do we learn to articulate how do we advocate for ourselves? How do we self-soothe in a healthy way? How do we regulate our emotions when we are triggered, and learn how to take space? You know, you were talking to me before we recorded about how you are approaching work differently, how you now have a big event, and guess what? We're booking in some really serious self-care time, and that does not look like a bubble bath and a bath bomb.
It's not
self-care, you know, like Steve Gilbert talks about it a bit, boring self-care. It's taking care of ourselves, it's giving us time to rest intentionally without being go all the time, because let's face it, bipolar lets us do that quite well.
Oh yeah. I get a lot done.
We don't need any. Oh yeah, we get a lot done. We don't need a lot of help.
Yeah, I don't need coffee sometimes. I've got to say, bipolar can be a strength. That's how I got my event done, you know.
But then, you know, you're being mindful of what do I need to factor in afterwards. It's like buffering ourselves, right? How do I buffer myself here, keep myself safe, and take the very best care of me?
Absolutely.
Given in the to account, like all of these other factors that we've got going on, unresolved trauma, all these things. It's not just I've got bipolar. It's not.
And what you have touched on is so important, been significant for me. It is not just bipolar, mm-hmm. as well. Living with PTSD, anybody that has trauma, we also have to look after our triggers.
Yeah.
And I'm in a situation myself where I'm still learning my trauma and the sexual abuse I went through because of other generational influences for myself. I told nobody at all. I had a secret for so long. And then you get used to having secrets. So when you get ill, you have secrets. So people don't even really know how ill you are. Yeah. So you're not just juggling bipolar, you're juggling the trauma, the nightmares, triggers, and then self-care to fit in with loads of different things. And then also for me, unfortunately, I was informed that I also have a diagnosis of a personality disorder and learning what that means. Mm-hmm. So when I invest in self-care, it's almost for three different things as well. Yep. So it's being mindful of that environment. And also what I have learned recently with my therapist is boundaries, because I had no boundaries before. One of my part of my personality in the way I am is I'm very caring for others. I would spend more of my time looking after everybody else than looking after me. I mean, I'm not going to lie, I've had to learn what self-care was. I didn't even know what self-care was, let alone self-love, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, don't, yeah. This self-love thing, like, I just want to say, for people that have got a mental health condition, that have grown up with trauma, that have these things in their life, boundaries are a whole new language. Learning our emotional...
Oh, it's like learning Spanish.
Yeah, it's like... and also the guilt and the shame that comes with that when you first start doing it
absolutely.
Is another layer to work through.
Oh,
and I just think, like, we need to be kinder to ourselves, because I see on social media a lot, it's like, you just got to love yourself and, like, life will be amazing. It's like, no, you can't...
Mean?
You can't... Exactly. You cannot say that to somebody whose self-worth is on the floor, and they don't even know it most of the time. It's just how life has always been. They don't know any different. You can't say that to someone. We have to start with, this is I don't know how this feels for you, let me know when I say it, but a thing that was absolutely blew my mind, self-love was just, it all seemed too, like, fairy love and light, like, I was like, yeah, whatever, like, just, you're off in some la la land. But you know, just think your way out of it, positive affirmations and all that, yes, there's a place for it, but it doesn't solve everything. And I just feel that the statement, I matter as much as someone else, was an absolute revelation for me.
I'm on the same page as you, Emma. I had no understanding what self-care was. If you asked me what self-care was, I honestly couldn't tell you. If you asked me what self-love, I can tell you. And I remember, not that I got frustrated with my therapist, but when she was telling me, and she'd give me homework, right? And then I would feedback the next week. How did you get on with your homework? And I would have to be honest, I struggled, didn't know. Then her response was, well, Bella, you've never done it before, so you are going to struggle with it. And I was like, oh. And then I got frustrated with her. I said, wait, you know, I've still got my education. I'm a successful professional speaker in mental health. I'm a podcast mental health. How comes, where's my education to know what self-care and selfless? I got a bit frustrated with her. And then she explained, somebody coming from trauma, such as me, are self-esteem is on the floor. We have no self, you know, so it, self-care and self-love, I'm learning. So it's very correct, Emma, when you see on Instagram or people tell you self-love, it might be easy for them, but in our content it wasn't, and it's a relearning, a bit like the culture issue we're talking about, you know, it's a relearning. And I'm taking it. And then the other thing, what I stand strong for is individuality. What you might do for your self-care, read a book, whatever you want, is going to be different to what I do. And it's okay. That's one thing I'll stand strong, because there's a lot of things I might like, people will think is very peculiar. But if it's making me happy, you know, like, I can sit and play with balloons all day and my whole house looks like a wedding venue and I'm happy, right? That might not, you might think that's really hard or difficult, but you know what? That's relaxed me like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah, it's so individual, you know, like, what we need to regulate, to calm, to self-soothe, and learning what that is for us, it's going to look different on everyone.
And you have to accept and be compassionate for each person.
Oh gosh, yeah. And Bella, can you tell us about what you do? Because you are working tirelessly to change the way people think in the Black community, and to empower them and to encourage them to use their voice and identify. And I think this is the important part that we touched on before we started recording, have the language and the awareness to even identify that they may have a mental health condition or something that needs attention in their emotional well-being.
Thank you, Emma. I work as a professional speaker within mental health, and I'm also a podcaster. My podcast is called Think Tenacity Podcast. I do come from a commercial world before launching into mental health. I am also a professional speaker in the world of business networking.
Mm-hmm.
I actually became the first Black UK networking guru speaker. So I've transferred those skills into the world of mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And the need was, in my community, we do not use our voice enough to communicate if we are struggling with mental health, and we don't know the language, as we said.
Mm-hmm.
What words, how do we describe we're not well, and more or less to identify when we are going through certain symptoms. So I've chosen to bravely share my story through online Zoom events that we have. We recently launched an event launch in Harlesden on the 30th of September with the project Making Time for Black Mental Health and How to Break Stigma. And we have a wonderful heart-shaped red, gold, and green icon. So to make a change, we have to see other role models and other Black people talking about, hey, I've got anxiety, this is what I go through, I've got trauma, I have depression, whatever that common mental health condition. We need to hear more people in our community talking about it. We also need to hear success stories. So what I try to advocate is, yes, I've got bipolar. Yes, I've got PTSD. Yes, I've got a personality disorder. But you know what? Guess what? I'm still living my dream. I'm an entrepreneur running my business. And this is how I did it.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I overcame the challenges of childhood sexual abuse. This is how I overcome the challenge when I can't get out of bed in the morning. Mm-hmm. I'm honest and I tell everybody, hey, I don't function till 11:30. So if you send me an email, sorry, not going to respond. I communicate better by text. Please don't send me a long email. It's going to take me longer to respond. So I'm sharing what my diagnosis is, what my symptoms are, but also how I adapt it into my life.
Mm-hmm.
What I also advocate is support and to get help. So to break that cycle where Black people in our community do fear going to the doctors with lots of reasons, as we discuss. So I share how I get treatment. So I be transparent and say, I take medication every day. Also, my medication sometimes has to be regulated. And I advocate that I communicate with my doctor psychiatrist that if I feel my medication is having adverse symptoms, can we talk about this with my GP so that others can know that this is how you can use your language and communicate. I also promote various mental health support, such as Bipolar UK, the e-academy, e-community in the world of business. We had an e-academy, your e-community website, your app that you have, other ways that you can get support. I also advocate and give tips on when you're approaching your doctor, maybe use your phone and just put keywords on how you're feeling, or even show that to your doctor so that you're able to get the right treatment. But also using my voice and my podcast, I've created a website which details some of the common mental health conditions, which I mentioned, anxiety, depression, what those symptoms look like, so that people in our community where we have already a stigma and a cultural feeling of what does it feel like, that when they see some of these social media posts or on the website, they'll be able to recognize these are the symptoms and this is what I'm going through. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, using my voice to break down inequality is we as Black people will have mental health like everybody else, whether you're Black, white, orange, or purple. And also that mental health is health, and to break those walls down.
Yes. rather than splitting it from our physical health, you know, like it's a 360 approach, and our emotional and our mental health is critical. And if, like any part of us, right, our mental health can turn into a mental health illness, right?
Yeah, and I think in general, that's the biggest walls we need to break down.
Mm-hmm.
But also in my community, I do have to advocate that there is an element of our inequality.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we touched on there's a very low percentage of Black doctors.
Yeah.
And we had to address why that was at the event launch when I did a speaker engagement, highlighting why, and also looking at the statistics. That statistics show 1 in 4 people from Black communities, also known as BAME, do not talk about their mental health, although they don't share it. And that statistics is also from the Bipolar UK website. Mm-hmm. And I had to address, well, why? Because in our community, our culture to see change, I can't tell people we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to do this. No, they need to see why. Mm-hmm. And also our solution is we have to have access to break the walls of inequality to see and have the opportunity to speak with Black therapists.
Mm-hmm.
Because many reasons that there are symptoms of mental illness is also our racial traumas.
Yes.
Even we are celebrating Black History Month, which is a celebration, but also what that triggers is what Black history is. The reason we're celebrating it, we're celebrating it because there was slavery. Yeah. So we're trying to celebrate Black people, but the only reason we're celebrating it is because there was slavery. If yeah. there wasn't slavery, we would all be equal. Mm-hmm. And then we have to then be triggered how we're here, how my grandparents are here.
Yeah.
Because what happened in slavery, and then slavery only ended 150 years ago, and there's still racial tension. Mm-hmm. My grandparents came here, as we say, on the boat, because mm-hmm. the UK called for them. And then when they were called into the UK, as soon as they got off the boat, say, there was still racial tension. So by seeing a Black therapist, some of those racial traumas can be addressed that maybe a white person or another non-Black person may not recognize. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but if I had to go to Ireland and do a presentation about Irish people, there's only so much I can say because I've never been an Irish person.
Yeah, no. And also the other part of what you're saying is what I'm hearing is that to go to a therapist takes courage, full stop, right?
Absolutely.
People are fearful. Now, to put this into a different context, and you can tell me if I'm hearing you correctly, it's would be for me to go to a male therapist having sexual trauma from
yes.
a man puts a barrier in the way for me to get the best out of that session, because I can't do the work because I'm dealing with a very confrontational trigger and hurdle before I can even access the work I've got to do because of the person that's giving me that treatment. So what I'm hearing you say is that that works in a similar way for Black people not being able to access a Black therapist that would understand and be able to relate to their individual trauma because of the community, because of slavery, because of everything that the Black community has gone through. So to force them into situations where they cannot have therapy from people from their own community, to me, puts a hurdle in the way before they can even start the work.
Absolutely. And I will tell you this as a fact within our community or any community. If you are struggling with any element of mental health or mental health problem and you don't seek help,
mm-hmm.
as you know, like bipolar, if we miss our medication or we do something, it will go downhill. Mm-hmm. So if you don't address your mental health problems, you will deteriorate. The symptoms will get worse. The repercussions mean most people will turn to self-harm or self-treatment of their own, which could be excessive clubbing. Yeah. It could be
self-harm comes in all forms. It's not just self-harming, right?
Comes in all forms. Yeah. It's not just drugs, alcohol or sex. It's so many different things.
Yeah.
And then that then exacerbates the mental health and gets it worse. And then the other thing is, in our community where I'm an advocate, we do have a fear, obviously, going to a doctor, but some of us don't even know what a therapist is or the role of a therapist or treatment. So I will advocate and say, yes, I've taken medication and I also see a therapist and outlay what a therapist is. And also some people don't know that there are Black therapists out there and how to access them.
And that's, you know, I think advocating for what you need to bring down the barriers that you have to get across to even get the help that you need is key, right? So just having the awareness.
Awareness
that you can ask for what you need. Actually, no, I would prefer to have a Black therapist, please. You know, just knowing that you can say that, which we can, we absolutely can. But it's not knowing, right? You come from a place that, oh, I don't know if I can ask that. And it's empowering people to know they can.
And that's what is known in our Black community. There's a lot of uneducation within mental health. There's a lot of people that don't know some positive aspects of mental health that will help them get from A to B. A lot of people don't know that. And also, obviously, breaking down those walls of being confident and motivated. And as I said, the solution of that is using your voice. The more Black people are able to see other people that look like them sharing their story, which we try to promote on social media. We have a hashtag Talk on Wednesday. So they can see other people's story. I currently have a campaign on my website of Black inspiring role models who believe and advocate for mental health, and they share some of their stories. I'm trying to get as many as possible. We're trying to get two out on the website every week. So that's so important for them to see other people interview. And I have to be mindful, being the founder of my website, Bella Rarewood Bipolar, is that our community are very visual. As I said, we're all about show, how we look, you know, looking our best. So visual, and I make use of social media, our Instagram, our Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, we're very visual. Or the event, Zoom is great, but also in person is better because you're seeing people, you can ask questions, you could be a bit more free. So I also try to do our communication marketing very online focused, and WhatsApp, using, we have a great WhatsApp group as well.
What you're doing is so needed. And like you say, the more that people can see people they can relate to sharing their story, the more people will feel confident to say, actually, maybe I need that help, or maybe I need to advocate for myself. And I just think the work that you're doing is absolutely crucial in helping people have the confidence to do that for themselves when they need to.
Thank you so much for that, Emma. And my biggest goal is, I hope anybody, or more specifically, as we are celebrating World Mental Health Day's inequality, that another Black person in my community does not have to wait 13 years, as I did, to become brave to share they have a mental health issue or a mental health problem.
Yeah. I'm with you, and I just, it makes me feel incredibly sad that people feel that they cannot, you know, share this, and in this fear sort of what would happen if I do. And I hope that by what you're doing, and we have other ambassadors as well, for Bipolar UK. And I just think that with everybody doing their bit, that can encourage people to not have to suffer in silence for as long as you have.
Absolutely, you hit the words on the hammer, and that is the mission, to help people reduce that fear of submitting to silence, because I did it for 13 years. I know what that pain felt like. And if I could help another person, even if it means in their own private time, as I said, social media is great. They can see something and it makes them feel great, or helps them with their self-care, and they feel like they can recognize and not live in silence, that would be wonderful.
Well, Bella, I am certain you are doing that for people. And I'm so grateful for your time today. And thank you for this lovely conversation that I hope will help many other people as well.
Fantastic. Can I add one element, an achievement of our not-for-profit organisation?
Please do.
I'm ever so grateful for a sponsorship from the Royal Kensington and Chelsea Borough, who are sponsoring our upcoming Black Mental Health event, which will take place on the 27th of October. And that makes me feel that what we're doing is being recognised and we're on the right track.
Yes, you absolutely are. Please, will you send me the details of that, and I'll pop it in the show notes as well.
Oh, thank you.
That people can access everything that you're doing. So send me all the things. I'll make sure it's in the show notes and people can access you.
Oh, thank you. And Emma, I think we'll definitely have to stay in touch on WhatsApp, because I can't do email a lot. So I need to share. I want to hear some more of your self-care and self-love tips. We need to trade off, you know.
We can do that.
Yeah, you need to share some of those with me. Thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.